Jake Runnestad is living the American dream right now with the release of his new recording, The Hope of Loving, featuring the Austin-based choral ensemble Conspirare. When he started out composing, Jake thought, maybe one day Conspirare will record one of my pieces, but to have them record a whole album of his works, well, that's a dream come true. That's this edition of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher. I'm talking with Jake Runnestad, who is a young American composer who writes all kinds of music, but in this case, we're going to be exploring a new collection of choral works that are all Jake Runnestad pieces. The recording is called The Hope of Loving, featuring the ensemble Conspirare. Welcome, Jake.
Thanks. Great to be here.
I want to start at the very beginning, where you grew up in Rockford, Illinois, in a very musical family, and I'd love for you to tell me a little bit about your family, including your grandfather, who was referred to as Svenska Sinatra.
That's right. Yeah, very, very musical family growing up. We sang a lot around the house. We had a piano, and so I would go to the piano and begin plunking out melodies that I heard, and that led to little piano pieces, which led to a lot of terrible love songs in high school and being in several bands. And then I started notating music. And so my senior year, I wrote a piece for my high school wind ensemble. And that's when I really got bit by the composing bug and just fell in love with creating music that other people could perform. So I went to college to be a high school band director. I met composer Libby Larson, who encouraged me to really pursue composition as a career. So I went to graduate school, got my master's studying with Kevin Putz, and then started trying to make my life happen as a composer.
I think it's kind of interesting that you started to learn how to orchestrate way back in high school when you were literally just doing some multi-tracking with some of these bands you were in. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's really how I learned. So I saved up all my money and bought this beautiful digital multi-track recorder with a built-in CD burner. And I would lay down a piano part and then a string part with my keyboard and then guitar and vocals and harmonies and saxophone. So I learned how to put all of these things together without really reading any music for it at all. And I wasn't that great at reading music at that time, but just loved making those sounds and spent hours and hours in this little makeshift studio I made in my basement.
And until Libby Larson sort of planted that seed, it really had never occurred to you that you might become a full-time composer?
I knew that I'd always be creating music, and I thought it would be like Mr. Holland's Opus, where I'm teaching band and then composing in my free time. And Libby really opened my eyes to show that it was possible to have a career, and so she really was an important mentor to me.
How many pieces have you composed in all so far?
Oh, gosh. Probably right. Somewhere around 100 and something, 20, 120 maybe.
And that's been in the course of how many years?
I guess that's probably since high school.
Okay, because you're what, 30?
33.
Okay. So how many of those works have been choral pieces?
Oh, gosh, probably a majority. Yeah.
So it's pretty exciting to have your first recording that's all you and all choral works. Tell me about what that feels like.
Oh, it's an absolute thrill. And, you know, Conspirare is one of the finest ensembles in the country, if not the world. And I had always dreamed of maybe they would perform one of my pieces one day. And then to have been able to write two pieces for the conductor, Craig Hella Johnson, and now this full album, it's really a dream come true.
And do both of those pieces appear on this recording?
Yes, they do.
That you wrote for them? Mm-hmm. So how did the project come together? I mean, these things don't happen overnight.
Yeah, years ago, Craig and I were having a conversation, and I think the idea of recording came up, and he said, we'd be very interested in making this happen. It's going to be years down the road, so if you can be patient, I think this will be a really beautiful collaboration. And of course, I agreed. It was such an honor. And so, yeah, we did the recording in January down in Austin, Texas, and have been working really hard on edits and making the disc how we want it to be. And then we just released it. So.
And so did you work directly with the ensemble for this recording then?
Yeah, I was down in Austin with them, and we did two concerts. So I was part of the rehearsals for the concerts, there for the concerts, and then also there for the recording.
So what's that like for you as a composer to hear your works come to life? And this happens with different ensembles, but in this case, you're working with sort of an ensemble of your dream.
Yeah, and it's rare to have an entire concert dedicated to one's music. And in this case, to have an ensemble that performs at such a high level, but also with so much heart and so much depth, it was extraordinary. I was just giddy the whole time. Really just a special experience.
I know that finding the right text is really important to you, and you kind of let that set the tone, and then you build the music around that. Where do you go in search of these texts?
I look for texts everywhere. I'm constantly reading. I get a poem of the day in my email every day from the Poetry Foundation, and I am looking all over the place at journal writings and poetry and literature. So lots of different sources of these texts, and I spend a lot of time doing research for every piece that I write. I think that that's so important that I understand who wrote these words, what was going on in that person's life, in the world, in the culture, in their community, and how that influences the way that they wrote, and then how do I extract all that information and interpret the poem so that I can illuminate it through music.
The recording that you've just released with Conspirare is called The Hope of Loving. What's that all about?
So that's the name of one of the pieces that's on the album, and it's a piece for choir, string quartet, and soloists. And this piece is a setting of texts by mystics throughout history, and these are translations by Daniel Ladinsky. And the piece really explores the various aspects of love, which kind of sounds really general and maybe lame, but I feel like we don't necessarily think about that. If you pass someone on the sidewalk, why do you look away and not smile at them? And that short element of engagement can be a sign of love. And as we all know, we need that so badly in our world today with the way that we're so divided. For me, this piece really speaks to that importance of showing love to others, but also being able to feel that yourself.
So I want to talk about my favorite movement in that suite, which is actually the second piece, Wild Forces.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about this work. I just think it's breathtakingly beautiful.
Thank you. So this movement is kind of this rollicking, driving, energetic push into, there are beautiful wild forces within us. Let them turn millstones inside, filling bushels that reach to the sky. I think this idea that we have beauty, we have possibility inside us, and it's a matter of pushing forward and letting that out. So in the case of this piece, we ultimately have this possibility or this potential for love and showing it to others. And so we need to feed that in order for us to be able to exert that.
I was thinking it was interesting to me how the piece could become so powerful with just three lines of text. So it didn't take a lot to inspire you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those were very powerful words. In the piece of Wild Things, the layers just continue to build, and then that final line, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. I mean, it's kind of overwhelming.
It is. It's a beautiful poem by Wendell Berry, and in it he's looking at his life and he's looking at the world and how so many elements fill him with grief and with fear. He's looking at what his children's lives might be one day, and just the way that the world is moving. But then he remembers he can go and lie down where the wood drake rests in the beauty and the water, where the great heron feeds. He says, I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. So this idea that we can't control the future, we can control what's happening now. And I think that we will have less fear if we obsess about what we can't have that control over.
That's really hard.
It's very hard.
We really have to practice that.
Absolutely.
I was looking at this text for this piece, and it made me wonder if you as a composer, when you're looking at that blank page and you're going to start working on something, do you maybe go seek the beauty of nature? Are you feeling a little anxious when you're looking at that blank page? And how do you reduce your own anxiety as you're starting a project?
Yeah, the blank page is definitely very intimidating. And so when I'm starting to create, I usually am not working at the page right away. I'm processing ideas, I'm doing research, I'm improvising, I'm walking around singing the text to help discover the right motivic or melodic material for the piece. And as you'll notice on the album, a lot of the music deals with nature in some way, and it's something that I love and that I'm passionate about and passionate about protecting. And so I think that we have distanced ourselves as the human race in many ways from the natural world. You know, we even call it going into nature. You know, we've removed ourselves, we've built walls, we've built buildings. And I think that if we can begin to go back, to reconnect with trees, with animals in some ways, that it will be better for all of us in the long run, especially, you know, trees, which are so important to our survival. Another glorious day. And I was reading somewhere that if we plant, you know, whatever million number of trees, that it will help handle all of these issues of climate change and what's happening with the world. So, yeah, these are things that I think are really important, and so I tend to explore those through my art.
Come to the Woods is a good transition here. Text written by the founder of the Sierra Club, John Muir.
Mm-hmm.
And did he really climb a tree in a storm? Was that part of this, where he came up with this text?
He did. So John Muir was a fascinating guy, one of the fathers of our national park system. He helped found Yosemite National Park, became buds with Teddy Roosevelt, and was really important in that idea of protecting these lands in the U.S. He was a fascinating individual who would dangle himself over waterfalls to know what it felt like. And in the case of this piece, I took his journal writings. And this story is about when he's walking down the trail and he sees a storm coming and he wants to experience it. So he climbs a huge Douglas fir tree to the top. And I just imagine him whipping and flying back and forth on the top of this tree as the wind is whipping him around, and he's just loving it. And so that's what I tried to paint with this piece.
And of course, don't try this at home, right?
Right.
This is one of the pieces that you wrote specifically for Conspirare. How did you capitalize on what this ensemble can do?
Well, they can do just about anything. And so I really tried to explore color and character with this piece. So harmonically and melodically, there are a lot of fun colors to play with, different textures that I tried to create to paint maybe that scene of being in the woods, of hearing the mountain wind blow through the trees. Hear his excitement when he decides, I think I'll climb one of the trees for a wider look. And so I use a lot of really for me, freeing and fun techniques, because I knew that I could do just about anything. So it was a real joy to be able to kind of feel that almost limitless quality when I was writing. So it really allowed for a lot of creative freedom.
Can you explain one of those fun techniques and how we might hear that in this piece?
Sure. So near the end of the piece, there's this section where the tenors and basses enter with this chorale idea of "Come to the woods, for here is rest." And over the top of that, the sopranos and altos have these like four-note figures that they sing at random, just on ah, ba da 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 da, and they all do it individually and in their own time, and so it creates this wash of sound that, for me, is kind of a dream world, almost as if John had laid down for a nap and now he's dreaming about all that he saw, or even about his life and how it's led him to this point.
Let My Love Be Heard is an a cappella piece, and it's kind of taken on a life of its own. Would you talk a little bit more about how that's happened?
Yeah, so Let My Love Be Heard was commissioned by Choral Arts Northwest and Robert Bodie in Seattle, and they give a beautiful premiere. And then in 2015, Cal State Long Beach had lost a student in the Paris attacks, and the choir performed at this young woman's vigil at the school. And the next day, they were supposed to begin rehearsing holiday music, and they just weren't ready to move on. And so their conductor, John Talberg, contacted me and said, "Hey, can we have this piece? We'd like to record it and offer it to our community as a gift of love and of hope and of peace in this really difficult time." So in one rehearsal, they learned the piece and they recorded it, and it's extraordinary. And so since then, a lot of people have seen that story and taken on the piece in the idea of remembering someone who was lost. I don't know exactly what Nelford Noyes had in mind, the poet. I think it could be someone who was far away, someone who maybe had died. That's the beauty of art, is the way that we can interpret it in different ways. But now having this incredible recording by Conspirare, they kind of take it their own direction, and it's equally powerful and beautiful, and I'm really, really proud of that piece and this recording.
And this text, did it come from your grandfather?
Yeah, so when my grandfather died, he had a collection of books, poetry books, these little red books. And my grandmother gave them to me after he had passed. And so I found this text in there, and it's the only place I've ever been able to find this poem. Can't find it online anywhere. And yeah, so it's some kind of magical discovery, I think.
My soul is a candle. I listened to that again today. And to listen to that duet, I was thinking, wow, this could be like in a musical or in a modern opera. It's just that gorgeous and kind of memorable, you know, where you find yourself almost wanting to join in and sing with them.
Burned away.
Yeah, so this is part of The Hope of Loving. This is one of the movements. And I think it's this exploration of a romantic love and how beautiful that can be. And so the text is, "My soul is a candle that burned away the veil. Only the glorious duties of love I now have." And so these two voices, a soprano and a baritone, come together and sing these together as later on the ensemble kind of supports them behind and swells to this big climax. Yeah, I just really wanted to create that intimate moment of beauty and simplicity. You know, it's not a very complex movement necessarily, but I think music can be so powerful when it's not so complex.
The baritone soloist in this piece, Simon Barad, says that his favorite part is when the choir surrounds him because he really could feel the love of everybody in the room. How do you feel when a singer has that type of a reaction?
It means the world. We as composers, we spend so much time in solitude creating these works, and then we put them into the world and hope that they might have an impact, hope that people connect with the music. And so just to know that the performers find a way in and find beauty or are able to connect with it means the world. And then also for those who hear the music, to learn that it means something to them is just one of the best feelings. It's why I keep doing it.
The recording opens up with a piece called Waves. This was the first time that you had the chance to work with poet Todd Boss. Tell me about this piece.
Yeah, so Todd also lives here in Minneapolis, and he's an extraordinary poet in his own right. And we met when I first moved here per the recommendation of a friend of mine who's a librettist in New York. He said, "Oh, there's a great poet there. I read him in The New Yorker. You should get to know him." And I said, "Okay." So I contacted him and we met for coffee and didn't collaborate right away. But a few years later, we decided, let's try this. And so I remember sitting down at a cafe outside and I attempted to tell him what I look for in a text for music. Simple language, open vowels at climactic points, so it allows for the voice to open up, and lots of other things. And so he was taking copious notes and then created this beautiful poem called Waves. And yeah, it was our first collaboration, and I'm really excited that it opens the disc with a beautiful solo by tenor Mike Jones.
One of the things Mike had to say about this piece is that he's really inspired by the human connection that this work inspires. Can you elaborate on that at all?
So the text is someone who's at the ocean's edge, looking out over the vast expanse of the water and searching for meaning in life. I think this person's in a very low place. And sometimes we do that. We go to these things that are bigger than us and maybe hope for an answer. And so the individual is there at the side of the water, and then near the end of the piece, the sun begins to rise and throws this warmth of light onto that person. So there's this, I think, very human quality of how we all deal with difficult times in our lives. And for me, I do go to nature to try to find meaning. And I think in this case, just that idea that the sun will always rise is an important image for all of us to remember.
Another collaboration that you did with Todd Boss is the piece called And So I Go On.
So this work was commissioned by Jonathan Talberg, who is a conductor in California. And John was on tour in Europe with his choir, and his fiance Hermann was also on the tour, was also a choir conductor, and they were performing in Italy. And during the performance, Hermann passed out and died at the front of the church in John's arms. It was incredibly sad. And several months later, John was cleaning out Hermann's wallet, and he found one business card inside, and it was mine. I had met both of them earlier that year at a conference. And so John asked me if I would write a piece in Hermann's memory. And so I went to Todd and said, hey, here's this concept. We'd love to write this piece in memory of Hermann. It would be for double choir, as the two voices, the one who's still here and the one who's gone, are talking back and forth. And Todd wrote this extraordinary text. And so I go on, and it's a really special piece to me. It helped me to become deeper friends with Todd, but also then John has become one of my very, very dear friends through this process. And so it's amazing how in light of such terrible loss, all three of us were given these gifts of friendships through this creative process.
Why the Cage Bird Sings starts off kind of crunchy and dissonant, and then soprano Alyssa Ruth Suver, who is the soloist, loves the part in that work where it becomes a prayer. Would you talk a little bit about that piece, please?
Yeah, this text is a really powerful one by Paul Laurence Dunbar, and this is where Maya Angelou got the title for her book, Why the Caged Bird Sings. It's from his poem. He was born to parents who were previously enslaved and later freed, born just after the end of the Civil War, and lived in Ohio and Dayton. And this text is really about tension. It's about, I know why the caged bird beats his wings. I know why the caged bird sings.
I know why the caged bird beats his wings.
And so I tried to capture that that tension, and I think that our culture is in the U.S. is so plagued with racial strife in many, many ways, and we still are. And so I think it was really powerful to explore that idea with this work.
And the entire recording wraps up with Flower into Kindness. Why was this the right way to wrap up this beautiful project?
Flower into Kindness feels like a perfect meditation after we've been through all of these texts that I just adore throughout the album. And the final text for this is, I shed my words on the earth as the tree sheds its leaves. Let my thoughts unspoken flower into kindness. And I use the idea of a round or a canon, where it's one melody that is looped on top of itself. And in this case, it's done seven times. And my feeling is that this meditation, this idea, is just wrapped around the ensemble, wrapped around those who hear it. And I think it's a really great way to close out this disc, that idea that what we meditate on, what we think about, and have inside of ourselves, if those are beautiful, good, positive things, that they will then come out as good, beautiful, and positive things as we live our lives.
That's new classical tracks from American Public Media. Jake Runnestad talking about the new recording, The Hope of Loving, featuring the ensemble Conspirare. Special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. If you're enjoying new classical tracks, the absolute best thing you can do for this show is to tell somebody about it. Help spread the word about new classical tracks, and then take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. I'm Julie Almacher.